what is self-worth truly? And what are all the different things that contribute to and make up self-worth? Whether that be socially, culturally, intrapersonally, within our own families of origin, within our own values and beliefs that we've developed. There are numerous things that add up to create the way we think about ourselves in the dynamic of our place in the world. And there are lots of these things that I think it's important we consider, but one that I have not considered before, at least until this conversation, was alcohol. How does alcohol impact the way that I think about myself and my relationship with other people? Hey y'all, I'm Reese, and welcome to Making Meaning. Making Meaning is a podcast by the Cohere Collective, here to help guide you along your path to make meaning in a way that makes sense for you. This week, I am joined by Coach Marcy Rossi. Marcy is an expert in several different areas, one of them being business expertise and helping coaches and passionate entrepreneurs kickstart their businesses. But the other one is alcohol and living a life alcohol-free once she discovered how dependent she had become. I think one of the most fascinating things about our conversation is that her decision to live alcohol-free wasn't based on hitting rock bottom or this overwhelming need to go through this overhaul because of severe addiction and dependence, but was because of a decision she came to within herself. She was ready to have more clarity and focus, and it seemed like the right time to kick this habit, not necessarily because it was in control of her, but because she wasn't the one in control. If this is your first time over at the Cohere Collective, welcome. We are so glad that you're here. And wherever you are listening to the podcast, please like, review, subscribe, leave a rating, leave a comment. All of these things are truly the best way to support our work of helping people find and pursue purpose. If you would like to follow us, please do so wherever you're listening, but also you can do so across all social media, all at the Cohere Collective. You can also find Marcy, everything to access her, her work, and contact her if you are interested in working with her will be in the description down below. A brief content warning before we dive into the episode. Marcy and I discuss addiction and alcoholism throughout basically the entire episode. So if any of those topics are going to be particularly upsetting or difficult for you to listen to, please engage with this episode with care. I believe that is all I have. So let's take a deep breath. And get started. First and foremost, yes. Marcy, thank you so much for being here and sharing this time with me this morning. I'm so grateful to be having this conversation with you.
Me too. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. First question, just to kind of set the note for our podcast, is what's one thing you're grateful for right now?
Right now, I actually this morning got a text message from my cousin asking me to be the goddaughter of her second child. So I will say I kind of beat her into it a little bit, just kind of constant hint, hint, nudge, nudge, you better sort of thing.
Sure.
But it actually went through. And so, yeah, I'm really excited. I feel very honored that she's going to allow me to kind of take part in her daughter's life. So
that's beautiful. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
What a huge honor. I love that. Yeah. Second question that will really be jumping pad for us to crack open our conversation is, what is your story? Obviously, that's a big question. Whatever sure. you feel called to share in this moment is perfect.
Okay. Well, my story has a lot of pieces and twists and turns, I would say. So I started out this high achiever in school. Like, school came really naturally to me. Sports did not, but school was my jam. I was straight A student doing really well. And so I knew that I was like, big things were going to be my future. So then I went to business school when I graduated early. I then went to law school and I became a certified attorney. And then from there, I went into the corporate world. I was actually working at Ernst & Young, one of the big four accounting firms, for a few years. I loved what I was doing, but it was just there was a really lack of work-life balance, right? It's a corporate world. It's a lot of high pressure. And while I was good at it, I wasn't making a difference. So, or at least not in my opinion. And so I pivoted actually into public libraries and worked my way up through public libraries, which again, I also really enjoyed, but not that perfect fit for me because there is a lot of bureaucracy and politics kind of in small government. In this midst of all of these different changes, I was drinking a lot to cope with stress. In particular, as a lawyer and in the corporate world, there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of high stakes. In my attorney journey, I was representing victims of domestic violence. So these are very high stakes situations, and it's really hard for me not to take those personally. And so to cope with that, I was relying on alcohol. And yet I wouldn't consider myself an alcoholic, right? So I wasn't getting arrested. I was doing just fine at work. Even when I pivoted into public libraries, I got promoted 5 times in 5 years. Like, everything was going really well externally, but at home, it was really hard for me to say no to that drink, right? I'm also very passionate about the healthy lifestyle. And so it was kind of in contrast to other things that I was doing. I'm trying to work out, I'm trying to eat healthy, and then I was drinking. So I would come up with these rules to say, okay, this needs to be limited. So only on the weekends, or only after 5 o'clock, or only X, Y, and Z, only to break those rules later, right? And that's where I found that I had this dependence. So I didn't find out just then. I actually tried a dry January. This was going to be my cleanse. I was going to give up alcohol for a month. And that first time, I think I ended up drinking maybe 2 or 3 times. But one of those was just like a really hard day at work. And another time it was a friend's birthday. We're going out. So like, those didn't count. And then I did dry January, year after year after that. And only once was I able to make it the entire 31 days without drinking. And I was miserable. I was thinking about drinking every single day. And so that to me signaled that this is a problem. It has more control over me than I would like. And in order to pivot, I knew I needed help. When I looked at the resources for help out there, I saw rehab, which I didn't need. I didn't need to be locked up. I just went 31 days without a drink, right? I could do it. Also didn't have $50,000 to throw on a extended time away from home. Then the other option was AA, in my opinion, and it didn't sit right with me. I told you I wasn't an alcoholic, right? I was doing just fine externally out in the world. It was just at home that I seemed to struggle. And, there's a big emphasis on letting go. And it just wasn't very empowering feeling for me. So I knew that wasn't a good fit. And fortunately, through the power of Facebook ads, I was introduced to a coaching program to help change your relationship with alcohol. And it was so transformational for me that I ended up becoming a coach myself. And I have been working to help women change your relationship with alcohol. And in doing that, I have started my own business, which I absolutely love. It's bringing in that business school entrepreneurial spirit and just have a lot of fun with that. So I've, now pivoted into helping women with their own small businesses. It's just been a lot of twists and turns, but all of it, I feel like, has been leading me to where I am here today.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. There is this beautiful thread throughout your story. I mean, even in you talking about like starting as a high achiever in school and like being at this accounting firm and trying to find this kind of thread of purpose. And then when you realized that you were struggling with something, taking that and using it to kind of propel purpose forward. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that you have this kind of desire to do something purposeful, even in that switch from corporate life to public libraries to having your own business? It's all really motivated by that purpose piece. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Great question. I think it comes down to, I want to say the value that I see in myself, right? So if I am not doing something to make a difference, then what am I here for, right? I'm not a very spiritual or religious person. So for me at the end of the day, if I'm going to be here and I'm not trying to fulfill this purpose to try to help somebody, if I'm not trying to help, period, then it's just a purely selfish existence. And so like, what's the point, right? I'm not going to be able to change the entire world, but I can make a difference for somebody. And that for me validates my existence, essentially. It's a little heavy, but like, that's just where it is. It's why else would I be here if I'm not going to help somebody else? It just feels too selfish to me. So however that looks, you know, whether it's representing victims of domestic violence, even in accounting, I was, you know, turning it into a purpose of I'm helping to ensure that there is accurate information so that people, when they're investing, can make wise decisions. Like, you know, it's not going to change one's life most likely at the end of the day, but I feel like I'm contributing in some way. And that just makes it so much easier to get up and go out the door in the mornings, especially those days that you don't want to, when you feel that there's a reason behind what it is that you're doing.
Absolutely. And I love that you're mentioning that this is kind of rooted in just your own personal morals and values, not being an especially spiritual religious person. Mm-hmm. Where do you ground those values in? I think it absolutely is possible to not have a spirituality or religion and still have that really strong ethical code. Where do you think that stems from for you? And how have you kind of crafted this code that provides that motivation?
You know, I took a philosophy class in college because it was a liberal arts college. So we have to kind of experience a whole bunch of different things. Hated it. I will say I hated it. But they have all these, you know, talk about kind of moral codes. And I will say that mine is based on my own sense of justice. I think that's what led me to being a lawyer. And it's also what led me to leave the field. So I have a really strong sense of what is fair, what is equitable, what is right. I don't know that it's based in some specific moral code other than just my own and what feels right to me. But that is where that's what motivates a lot of my actions. You know, in law, the purpose behind it was to do what's equitable and what's right. And even in law, there's a lot of politics, as we can see from judgments that come down from the powers that be, right? So that was really hard for me to, in law, even just working with domestic violence victims, actually in particular, one of the clients that I represented was a woman who ended up killing her husband, but it was out of self-defense, right? He was holding a gun to their baby's head, like years and years of trauma going through this. And she got this incredibly harsh sentence because there is this vision in our world that when a woman kills, there must be something seriously wrong with her. There's, you know, men, yeah, of course, right? The men are most likely going to be the murderers. But when a woman does it, she must be so depraved, not thinking about kind of the situation that she'd been put in through years of systematic abuse. So that's where that sense of justice, it's really hard for me. I can't force people to open their eyes and see like what you're doing is wrong. She was just trying to protect herself. So that sense of justice, it was hard to sit with me. But again, going into the library world, right? This equity, I want equal access to information. I want people to be able to have the resources so that they can make the best choices for them and for their lives. So yeah, it's coming just from what feels right to me, but it definitely justice is something that guides really all of my decisions and my actions. Yeah.
No, I love that. I similarly am a very justice oriented person. And even from a very young age, I've always struggled with, well, that's not fair.
Yes.
And my dad always has this refrain, well, life isn't fair.
Yes.
And I'm like,
they must teach that at parenting school somewhere. Yeah.
Totally. But then I was like, okay, well, then what can I do to make life more fair? Because if that is the problem, then we need to make it more fair for everyone. And I would have to imagine in your work now around alcohol and dependence or the relationship with that, there has to be a lot of, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but sure, I would imagine a lot of like this equity, social justice piece in there as well because of different societal and cultural ripples. Have you experienced that to be true? And like, how does the justice piece connect to the work you're doing now?
So I haven't necessarily been experiencing it firsthand, but from what I've kind of witnessed and heard and read about and learned, there is sort of a couple pieces that play into that. One is the alcohol industry traditionally was something predominated by men, right? So it was men that were drinking and women were kind of taking care of the homes, right? And the alcohol industry realized that that is an untapped market. It's the same thing that they've been doing also with third world countries as well. They're realizing there's an untapped market there. So the alcohol industry has kind of taken on what I would consider predatory behaviors in intensely marketing to these places. And so you have countries like India, where traditionally they are not big drinkers, that are now have a growing alcohol problem, where, you know, people are actually making their own alcohol, and you're starting to see the consequences of that. Because there's profits to be made, right, at the end of the day. So for women in particular, that mommy wine culture, I'm sure you've seen somewhere where they have those comically large wine glasses or mommy juice or all these things. They look like funny memes that your friend came up with, but these are things definitely created by the alcohol industry in order to pull women in order to prey on their imposter syndrome, their feeling of not enough, this lack of worth, you know, to say it's okay that you can't do it all. Instead of changing these expectations that we have for women, you can just drink to deal with that lack of living up sort of thing. So there's a lot of pieces that play that come into it. And that's why I think that getting rid of alcohol can be one of the most empowering things that you can do. You're no longer a victim to a system that's set to keep you down, right? If you're drinking and you're at home, you're not improving yourself. You're no longer willing to accept all of the inequities in life instead of just drinking to ignore them. So there's a lot of power there at play. And I think one of the most empowering things you can do is to say that I'm not going to be a pawn anymore in this game.
I love that. And it really is so empowering. Not only, I mean, in that realization and saying I'm not going to be a pawn, of course, extremely empowering, but then even that first initial step of realizing, oh, this funny meme that's being reposted on Facebook or Instagram or wherever is actually a trickle-down effect of a way to keep me in this system, in this place that is easily controlled. In your story, you mentioned being a very high achiever, bright future ahead of you, good at school. Certainly relate to that experience. And I think we're also seeing this cultural shift of the classic high achiever, gifted and talented kid, especially for women growing up, hitting this kind of like late 20s, early 30s and being like crashing, right? Like I used to be able to do all these things and now I'm not. Talk to me about your relationship there, because when you were just talking about alcohol, you were saying that it's a way to kind of cope with this feeling of not good enough. Mm-hmm. And I do think that perfectionism and this classic high achieverness stems from that same feeling of not good enough. Yeah. What is that piece of the puzzle?
I would definitely say that not good enough is often one of the key pieces underlying that alcohol use. Initially, at the more of a surface level, we're looking at what it is that you're drinking for. You're drinking to relax, you're drinking to celebrate, you're drinking to network, etc. But underneath all of those, essentially, there is this that lack of not feeling enough, of not feeling worthy, right? I'm drinking to feel more confident because I myself am not confident. I'm not worthy enough for people to come and talk to me. I don't have enough to say. I can't justify my existence, etc. So I think there's a lot of that. I will say I'm not kind of an expert in this area, but what I've seen essentially is there's women, the expectations on women, whether it is from just essentially the patriarchy or just what we do to ourselves, there is these standards that we've created that are impossible to live up to, that don't seem to be reflected in the people identifying as male. You know, like I don't know what the exact stat is, but they've said something like when there's a job application out there, a job posting out there, men will apply if they can meet, I think, 50 or 60%. And women, it's something somewhere like 90, 95%, right? Like we just don't feel like there's enough that we're constantly having to prove ourselves. And I think it's interesting with that alcohol piece, because we don't actually develop the opportunities to really thrive when we are drinking, right? We're drinking to suppress these feelings of not being enough, but all it's doing is perpetuating that, right? Like, yeah. if it's that confidence thing, if we feel not confident or not very interesting to talk to, we're not going to develop what are essentially skills that can yeah. be learned, because we're not having to test it. We're just escaping it. So I think part of it is just not realizing the role that we play and kind of keeping ourselves locked in this trap. Mm. That said, I definitely still suffer with, you know, imposter syndrome, with not feeling worthy, with all these kind of value related things. It's just, it's something that's definitely deeply rooted in our society. And if I can do the tiniest piece in helping women realize that they're a lot stronger than they give themselves credit for, that they don't need alcohol for absolutely anything, then I think I'm yeah. fulfilling my purpose there.
I adore that. And I think that that is so true. This like idea of like alcohol being a social lubricant yeah. is rampant in that, oh, it'll be so much easier to just have a glass of wine and then I will be more interesting or easier to talk to. Or if I am at a networking event and I am trying to like subtly, subconsciously impress, but also in the boys club nature of a lot of corporate and business worlds, I've even found myself like, oh, I'll order an old fashioned instead of a white wine, yeah. you know, to kind of play into that game for yeah. the social currency of what that is. I would love to hear more about, because you mentioned like this really fulfilling the purpose of helping women recognize this and the role we play in our own perpetuation of the cycle. Mm-hmm. What does your approach look like? Someone comes to you. How do you begin kind of unraveling this narrative?
For sure. So I will say that obviously everybody's journey is unique, but there are common threads that I see kind of over and over again. What we do is, together with me and my clients and I, are we look at the beliefs that we have, because my approach takes the TFAR cycle, right? So we look at thoughts that lead to our feelings, which drive our actions, which lead to our results, right? So we have to start with that thoughts piece. We have to start with what it is that we think and believe about alcohol and understand how that is driving the actions and results that we're getting. For some of those pieces, it's simply a matter of dispelling the myths. There, for example, the alcohol helps me relax. When you look at the actual science, it does not, right? Alcohol increases adrenaline and cortisol over time. People that drink regularly have higher base levels of cortisol. So even the smallest thing feels overwhelming when you are drinking regularly. And this is something I can speak to personally. I would have times where my anxiety would get so bad that I would, you know, hide under my desk, couldn't check emails, couldn't answer the phone. My husband would have to screen things for me because in my head, everything was just going to be so much worse than it was. And I can tell you, I haven't had any of those related anxiety attacks since I quit drinking. My stress level, obviously I get stressed sometimes, but not nearly to that level, because my base level of what is a stressor is so much lower than it was when I was drinking. So sometimes the science can combat that. Alcohol helps me sleep. Absolutely not. It's going to knock you out, but you're not going to get any REM cycles, right? So I have not found an article anywhere that says alcohol is going to help you sleep. If you Google alcohol and sleep, all of them are going to be in the negative. For stress, sometimes they can kind of they can interpret the results the way they want. I think that's something to recognize when we read these studies. There was one study, it's a study of studies, I'm in a study back in, I want to say 2014, that found over 13,500 studies related to the effects of alcohol were funded directly or indirectly by the alcohol industry. So in interpreting these results, it's important to kind of keep an eye on who is benefiting from the conclusions that we're making. So sometimes the science is enough to say, that's just not what the science says. You know, for example, another one is the living longer, right? The resveratrol or alcohol helps your heart or this, that, and the other. I am seeing all the time studies coming out and news articles coming out saying no amount of alcohol is safe. Now, that being said, if you still want to drink knowing the facts, then more power to you, but there's no power to you if you don't know the facts, if you're blatantly being lied to, right? Some of those I can't disprove scientifically. I can't say that you are X percent more confident when you have a drink than when you're not. What I can do is help you realize what that belief, how that belief makes you feel and therefore your reactions, right? If you say, I cannot network successfully or at all without a drink, you are essentially saying that the drinking makes you better, right? Which means you are less than without it, right? And how does that make you feel? Like knowing instead that maybe I'm not as confident now because I need to build up that skill. You can build up a skill. Anybody can get better at doing something if they work at it long enough, right? So that's the more empowering approach that I tend to take is really taking a look at those specific beliefs that we have. Alcohol helps me celebrate, network, relax, have fun, party, whatever that thing is, and realizing what it's actually doing to our reactions. And do we like the way that it's making us feel at the end of the day? Because I personally don't need yet another thing telling me I'm not enough, including myself. Yeah. So if I can find a way to let that go, it's time to let that go.
Wow. The quote of, I do not need another thing telling me I'm not enough. There is such a strong narrative, especially for women, like has kind of been a common thread through a conversation of that women are continually told you're not enough. Yeah. And that's, we see so many industries that profit off of this, right? Yeah. The beauty, hair, makeup, clothing, fashion,
diet, everything. I mean,
yes. Well, and one thing that I've actually been considering a lot as two professionals in this field is the way the self-care industry even profits off of how can you be better? What do you need to do to be the best that you can be because you're not enough right now? And how can we change our language around this to say you are enough right now? But that doesn't mean that you can't continue to improve and grow, but not you're bad. So you need these things to be better, that you're not enough. We're starting enough. That should be our baseline. Yeah. Wow. That is just so important. And I mean, I hadn't even thought about that in relationship to alcohol. Yeah. I'm so fascinated with the people that you find coming to you as well. Do you find that the women who are coming to you are like, I'm ready to make a change with alcohol, and that's how they're kind of stumbling upon you? Or do you find that you're meeting people and it's a slow process of them recognizing that alcohol may be an issue that they do need help with, or some third thing that probably is somewhere in between, right?
Yeah, I would definitely say it's a mix. I do want to preface this by saying that I don't work with heavily addicted women, right? There is, and this is something that I let all of my clients know. So alcohol is one of the few drugs, and alcohol is a drug. It's not drugs and alcohol. Alcohol is a drug, full stop. But alcohol is one of the few drugs that can kill you when you stop, right? It's a very small percentage. It's like 10% of the heaviest drinkers. But I'm not out here telling people that, hey, just quit and everything's going to be fine, because I recognize that some people are physically dependent and that giving up suddenly can cause, you know, strokes and even death. So the people that are in my wheelhouse are not that physically addicted, you know, where greater support is needed. This is more of a kind of a coaching, empowering conversation for people that are just like, I don't think this is serving me anymore. Mm. So with that being said, the people that come to me in different ways. I have had clients sign up because my message seemed to hit them at the right time. And they're like, yes, I'm in, like, this is what I need. I've also had people sign up for different things that I'm doing and then effectively ghost me. Now, I don't take that personally, because when I look at my own journey, I mentioned multiple dry Januaries where I'm like, okay, something's got to change. And even from that dry January, I actually signed up for a program in November of that year. There was no rock bottom moment. And I think that's also very important to clarify, that you don't have to hit rock bottom to simply decide that you want better for yourself. Mm-hmm. And so nothing like that actually happened to me. It just hit a point where I was sick and tired of it. You know, it just wasn't, I didn't want to do this anymore, but it took that time. It took that time from recognizing I had a problem to actually being willing to do something about it. And so a lot of people come to me in that middle phase. They may have a night where they're like, yes, I'm ready to do it. And then the next morning, as I've done many times, said to themselves, it's not that bad. It's fine. I got this. It was just last night, whatever. I'm not going to do that again. So I think what's important to recognize, I think loved ones want to know, I've gotten questions before about how I can help someone kind of get to that point. And I wish I had the answer. I don't have that answer yet. I don't think there's anything that I know how to do to force someone to get to that point where they're ready. They just have to decide in their own time, right? It's really for any kind of treatment. If you're talking about someone who's depressed, it's almost impossible to get them to just, they have to decide on their own, right? I've been that depressed person. They have to decide on their own that they're not willing to accept this kind of life anymore. So I don't have an answer on how to get someone to that point. When they're at that point, then I'm ready to go. Then we're ready to go. But so often people dip their toe in. Okay, I think I'm ready. And then no, it's actually not that bad because society is telling them that the only way to be happy is to drink. The only way to fit in is to drink. The only way to X, Y, and Z is to drink. And they're not that bad. They're not an alcoholic. It's not a problem. It'll be fine, et cetera, whatever excuses that we have to make, which at the end of the day, any reason that we drink is an excuse because we are ingesting a poison. And this is coming from someone who thought she loved drinking. I fully believed that I was going to be the person in the retirement home where people were going to be sneaking me drinks because I thought I loved it. And I say that because on the other side of this, a place I never imagined I would be, I also never imagined that life can be this rewarding, exciting, fulfilling, happy, any of those things. I thought I was happy, but I did not know what happiness was until I realized that there's not something that I need to get through life. I don't need anything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need a substance, at least. I guess I need food and water and I need my husband, but like generally sure. I don't need this additional substance to make me any better than I am. So.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. And even that goes back to the you're starting as enough,
yeah.
Right? Which is just, I feel like a refrain that needs to be said more and more and more. A piece of this puzzle that I'm personally very fascinated by, because I'm close to that this period of my life, have you experienced or have any opinion or research or anything about the effect of college on this relationship with alcohol? Because I know that the like judgment piece is so big in the, even if I want to stop drinking, even if this is no longer serving me, if I'm the only one at this tailgate that doesn't have a drink in my hand, I'm goody goody, not fun, stick in the mud, even if you're having a great time, right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. I will say that my target audience tends to be a little older because it is a really tricky time in there. Speaking from my own experience, I went to one of the most Greek universities in the country, and it was also one of the most affluent universities in the country. And so not only was drinking culture very heavily, but they had a lot of money to actually do it. That tends to be something that stops people, is just the costs associated. But when money is no object and you can get charter buses to bring you to and from the bars, it becomes a whole new world. We did have a one bar party where there was a camel. Like, this is this kind of money that they had because it was an Arabian Nights. And like, they had money and we were going to be able to party there. That said, I will say that there's been a very encouraging trend in the younger generations that they're realizing that alcohol is, quote unquote, their parents' drug. And so the alcohol use among Gen Z is much lower than it is for the older generations. Now, doesn't mean they're not doing something else instead and finding other ways to, quote unquote, cope. I say that because cope means to deal with successfully. And I think escaping in any form is not dealing with successfully, it's pausing. But that being said, alcohol is quite dangerous. So if people are going to find other alternatives, I'm not that upset about it. But yeah, in college, it is very hard to choose a path that's different from everybody else. That is the time you want to fit in. It's high school 2.0, right? It's high school with more money and more freedom and less parents. So it can be really challenging to forge another path. And this is just coming from someone not in that space and who probably wouldn't be listening to me when I was saying this. But there is something to be said with not being the one that jumps off the bridge when your friends do it too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if for no other reason, I think one in five, some, I don't know the exact stat, but somewhere around one in five women are sexually assaulted on college campuses. And I want to say 80% of those are alcohol related. I don't have the exact numbers, but it is that kind of dichotomy where it's like, this is happening and it's happening because of alcohol. So I can't tell you the number of times that I walked home alone in the dark and fortunately, nothing ever happened to me. Like, right. I am that very rare person that I've put myself at risk far too many times and happened to get out of it. But there's no reason for the number of times that I put myself at that risk. So that's another piece. I mean, yeah, you could want to fit in, but you might also not want to be at these increased risks for sexual assault, for overdoses, for all of the negative consequences that come with this. I think that's with every choice that we make in life, that there are consequences. And for young people, especially, remembering that those consequences are real and do occasionally happen, it can be really hard. But I think there's great power in deciding for yourself what's the best decision for yourself, especially knowing that the Sober Curious movement is growing. It may feel like everybody is drinking, but not everybody is drinking. Even before the trend started going down, I think only 70% of Americans over 18 were drinking. So you're not talking about everybody doing it. It feels like it, but it also is okay to find a new crowd, to actively search out a new crowd. And if you go on Eventbrite or Meetup or whatever, you can search for sober activities, things that are happening, to kind of find that new crowd that's going to support you. Because as they say, you're like the five people you spend the most time with. So if you want to be that frat boy camel party kind of person, I mean, you can surround yourself with these kind of people, or you can decide that you get one life and it's up to you how you choose to live it. And the people that care about your health, that care about you, aren't going to pressure you to drink just to justify their own drinking behavior, which is really what it is at the end of the day. When I've been that person pressuring to drink, and it's because I was insecure with my own drinking. If I were secure, I wouldn't really care if you're drinking, because it doesn't really matter, right? So recognizing that a lot of it comes from other people's own insecurities, and you know, you have to live with you at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, you have to make your own best choices. So
I think the piece about justifying your drinking is so vital, right? That it's like, if someone else is making this choice not to, what does that say about me that I'm unable to, or that I do want to drink? And that kind of spiral. And that leads to a lot of other, like you were saying, risky behaviors, and why we're seeing, I mean, you mentioned being at an extremely Greek university when you were in college, and this behavior around drinking is also heavily related to hazing and incidents and accidents and horrible, horrible things that happen because of that, and this pressure around it to kind of justify these behaviors, and the risk kind of calculation of this, especially for young people. I do think when we're younger, we have this sense of invincibility, like, oh, I know it happens, but it's not going to happen to me. Yes, I know that you can be an alcoholic, but that's not going to be me, because I'm just doing this in college right now and it'll change. Or I'm going to walk home alone, but it's not going to happen. I have my wits about me. I'll be fine, right? These kind of the justification that goes along with having to hold the cognitive dissonance of all of this, I think is really important. One thing I did want to throw out too, this the sober or just more thoughtfully drinking movements, I have started to see more and more and more, especially among my demographic, which I think is really exciting. And even so many restaurants have mocktail menus now. That's really exciting. So you can like still have a fun drink, but not have to sacrifice something that is important to you without getting an iced tea or a soda. Yeah. You can still get something really fun. One thing that I also wanted to ask you about is when people come to you, so you're kind of finding these people that are having made this decision. This is a habit that I am ready to actively interrogate. What is something that you wish that clients of yours or people that are actively ready to kind of make this next step, what's one thing you wish they knew before they came to you or started on this journey?
Oof, just one? Okay, there's a couple. I'm gonna preface this by saying.
Go into as many as you want.
There's a key one, but first and foremost, I think there is a significant lack of real information out there. There's just a mass amount of misinformation and disinformation. You know, even our alcohol bottles at the bottom, they'll say, don't drink when you're pregnant, don't operate heavy machinery, and may cause health problems. Pisses me off. Alcohol's been a confirmed carcinogen since 1988, meaning since I was born, alcohol's been known to be a carcinogen, and not like a, you know, it can cause cancer. It's at the same level as radiation, asbestos, and tobacco. We all know that tobacco causes cancer, and yet somehow with alcohol, it's probably a little bit off. Even with breast cancer, I think 3 drinks a week raises your risk by 15%. And yet they will put those little pretty pink ribbons on our wine bottles. Insane, insane to me. So I think a basic level of information of what alcohol does can be really empowering. And that way you're making informed decisions. I think informed decisions, someone who's so keen on justice, is really important. Again, we all make risky decisions all the time, right? We make, you know, some of us are, we'll eat fast food. We'll go, I went skydiving for my birthday 1 year. Like, we make risky decisions, but I can tell you, I know all the risks of skydiving because I had to sign like a 4-page contract saying, I will not sue you if I die or get maimed, right? I don't have that with alcohol. I just think it's fine as long as you're not an alcoholic. It might hurt your liver if you do it too much. And stop. That's full, all we know. I think the other really big piece is that alcoholic is not a real word. It is not a medical diagnosis. It hasn't been since 1980. They look at a spectrum of behavior, and most people would fall on minimum that mild spectrum. If you look at the questions, most of us are drinking more than we started, and most of us have had nights that we've forgotten, right? So that's it. You're on the mild right there. And that's not, so it's not so damning. It's not so, you're not so us and them type of thing. I think alcoholic is a really, really problematic word. And again, kind of going to a point I mentioned earlier, that you don't have to hit that rock bottom. You don't have to be an alcoholic to say, I want to change my habits. I want to change my behaviors. I want to do something healthier, spend my evenings in a more productive way, what have you. So I think that's a really big piece. And in tied to that, that there are options for making different choices if you need support. Some people are able to just put down the bottle and never pick it up again. Just simply knowing that it's not doing them any favors and taking that critical look, which so few of us do. We just keep doing without, you know, really analyzing our own behaviors. For some people, that's enough. For other people, they need more support, and there are support options out there. In terms of my strong feelings about the word alcoholic, just to kind of elephant in the room, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped a lot of people, and it's definitely a valid option for people. I think my personal, what doesn't work for me in the group is the focus on behavior. Right. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, kind of with that TFAR cycle, if you're just looking at the behavior, those thoughts and feelings are always going to be there. And you're always going to be feeling like you're giving something up, like you're missing out on something. I can tell you right now, I do not miss drinking. There's not a time where I'm like, oh, I just wish I could. Or like, I think people get that impression when I tell them I don't drink. They feel a little bad. Like, oh, is it okay if I drink in front of you? Like, more power to you. I don't care. I don't miss it. So I think when you can kind of remove the thoughts and beliefs that are driving that behavior, it makes it so much easier. You're not an alcoholic for life. You may have had a certain set of behaviors and you don't anymore. I don't believe that you can narrow someone down to a set of behaviors. I used to crawl. Believe it or not, when I was 1-2 years old, I was crawling. I don't crawl anymore, so I don't identify as a crawler, right? I used to drink. I don't identify as an alcoholic because I used to do one thing, right? So I think it can be quite problematic. And that just means that there's other opportunities if those don't sit well with you. If they do, they can be supportive and great and fantastic. If they don't, if you don't want to be penalized for being human and not doing things perfectly, I think other options can be a better choice for you. They definitely were for me. They are for the people that I tend to attract. And so knowing that there are different kinds of support options out there if something doesn't work. I mean, even honestly, even books. There are some fantastic books that can be really eye-opening and help you see some shifts in your behavior and really help you look more critically at what it is that you're doing. Those can also be enough. So there's a lot of options out there. I think in our society, we know of two. We know of rehab and we know of AA, or three is cold turkey, which is such a challenging thing for most of us to go about doing again, because we feel like we're missing something if we don't look at why we think we're missing something or what it is that we believe we're missing out on. So that I think is the really big key piece, that there are definitely different options out there. It's not just A, B, or C. There's a secret door to them, or there's D, E, and F. Lots of different choices for you to find support if one or two of the predominant theories don't sit well with you. I think that's really key. But yeah, just if you start to look at what alcohol actually does, it does for certain cause health problems. It is not a may. We need to let that go. We need to be honest with people. We need to stop letting the alcohol industry regulate their own warnings. I mean, just look at what they do when you have, like, if you take Advil, oh my God, the side effects that they list in your Advil bottle are extensive. And for alcohol, we give them a free pass, and it's just not fair. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, and even the statistics around it being a carcinogen and encouraging breast cancer, like, mm-hmm. I no idea whatsoever. And as a young woman, it's like, why didn't I know about this? And it goes back to what you were saying about knowledge being power, right?
Yes.
That we cannot make informed decisions if we are not informed. And if after having that information, someone's making an active choice of this glass of wine is worth it to me, it's like, at least you have the information and the knowledge before doing that. So is there any difference between what you wish you could kind of tell someone going into the start of this journey versus general public? If just looking at your average Joe, what would you like to kind of tell them about alcohol if you could boil that down into just one bullet point?
Yeah. So to your point as well, I also didn't know that alcohol was a carcinogen. Had no idea. I just thought it messed up your liver if you drink all day, every day. Like, that was the extent of my knowledge on it. So I think that is really important. It's just taking a look at the actual scientific consequences of drinking, reading things critically. I think all of this boils down to opening your eyes and being critical, right? Even when you're looking at those studies, there are studies out there that'll say that actually moderate drinking is healthy, or light to moderate drinking is healthy. And they conclude this because they have what typically appears as a J-shaped curve, where unsurprisingly, if you're a heavy drinker, that's when you suffer the most consequences of whatever it is they're studying. And then the light to moderate is down at the bottom, where they have the quote unquote best results. And then abstainers are actually a little bit higher. And so that's where you get that J shape. The problem is, in those studies, the abstainers are, it's not necessarily people that have never had a drink. Most often, people in this group are people that had to quit drinking because their health already necessitated it, right? And so you're saying, oh, well, this person who doesn't drink anymore is not healthy. Yeah, because they drink so much that they're not healthy to start with, right? One of them was insane. I mean, it was like the groups were that the light to moderate drinkers were white males who made more money, who had steady jobs, like, and the other people were not, right? It's just like, sometimes just having that critical eye and not blindly accepting everything that we're told. You know, we're in this culture of just constantly getting tidbits of information and reading the headlines. And if we can stop and slow down and actually take a look at what it is we're being fed and whether or not it makes rational sense to do something, if it makes rational sense to drink alcohol, to eat sugar, to sit all day, whatever the thing is that we're doing, you know, if you have the information and you choose to do it, we all do things that are probably, no one's perfect and no one has perfect health. We all do things that are probably not the best for us, but in most cases, we know it. We know that not exercising is going to hurt us. We know that sugar at a minimum is going to give us cavities and is probably going to cause a lot more issues. We just don't have the information around alcohol. And so we stop and one, take a look at, do I actually like this? Like, do I actually like spending my weekends hungover? Could I be healthier? Could I feel better if I stopped? We rarely ask that question because we just were on kind of autopilot at this point. And then when we start asking that question, we can dive into more information if we need more support on why maybe it's not the best choice for us. But opening our eyes and stopping blindly accepting everything we're fed and really being critical, I think, is key for anything that we do, honestly.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think this, I mean, the phrase you just used, blindly accepting, right? There's so many hidden variables that studies, if we do not have that trained eye to look at it. I mean, I remember in my very first stats class learning about these hidden variables and it being like ridiculously crazy things that you could draw a conclusion that makes absolutely no sense, but it's because of this very obvious other piece.
Yeah.
And like you said, we like grabbing those headlines. I think the information that you're spreading is just invaluable and really important for people to be making active choices. One thing that I think keeps coming up in this conversation as well is the idea of feminism and patriarchy kind of impacting these decisions. Of course, you work with women specifically. Right. Talk to me a little bit about that and why you are drawn to working specifically with women and the relationship between feminism and alcohol.
Great question. So the reason I enjoy working with women so much is that it's easier for me to relate. Obviously, I identify as a woman, and so it's easier for me to utilize my own experiences to help people through these different shifts. Now, one of those pieces that actually I'm missing on is I am not a mother, and that is one that we kind of touched on before, is a very heavily marketed demographic from the alcohol industry, you know, and kind of what that means. I think you don't have to relate to your client in every single aspect in order to kind of open their eyes to something. But, you know, for example, with that mother piece, a lot of those, it's kind of analyzing what this means for us and whether I'm willing to accept that statement, right? So for mothers that, you know, they'll have you, they like, oh, it's the most expensive part of being a mother is all the wine you have to drink and all of these memes that are meant to be funny. And yet, what is that saying to our children about mommy needing wine to deal with you? And what kind of cycle are we perpetuating then by sharing these memes and buying the funny glasses and t-shirts and whatever? So yeah, I think that there are unique challenges that I can speak to, perhaps not all of them, but just identifying as a woman that I can speak to for this particular demographic. I think part of it too, you know, we kind of touched on before with the boys club, right? You know, for women in terms of the patriarchy, like originally we weren't drinking and then drinking became a sign of freedom, right? It was a sign of us gaining our rights. We can drink. We can drink like the boys. I can have my old fashioned and my scotch and my whiskey and I can drink them under the table. I mean, when I would go out with my husband, you know, we'd order two different drinks and they'd put the pink frilly thing in front of me and the big old beer in front of him, and we'd switch when they would move because that's not what we had ordered, right? Like I was proud of my ability to hold my liquor, to be one of the boys. And so part of that again is trying to quote unquote combat the patriarchy in a way that actually ends up holding us down, right? We are not going to be our most effective selves if we are hungover, if we're tired, if our cortisol levels are spiked, if we are literally damaging our health in the process. So I think a really great resource on this is Quit Like a Woman by Holly Whitaker. It's a fantastic book. If you and your readers haven't read it, it's just really fantastic. It really speaks to the predatory behavior of the alcohol industry and really why quitting is an act of feminism. It is asserting your power. It is, you know, that sort of thing. I think it's really fantastic. So it speaks to a lot of those pieces. And she probably does a better job than I can clarify here. But yeah.
No, thank you so much for offering that. I'll provide links in video and podcast descriptions if anyone wants to check out that book. But this idea that even in drinking being a sign of freedom and a sign of empowerment, it is still upholding male as better or right. Male presenting as better, right? That I'm cooler because I drink brown liquor instead of clear liquor.
Yeah.
I'm a cool girl when I can have a beer instead of a fruity frilly drink, right? And that is something that is absolutely perpetuated. And even in this kind of gaining of our freedom, there is the sacrifice there as well, that it actually is holding us down. And I think we see that, of course, in alcohol. I think it's a really powerful example to think of, but across all sorts of things too, in the, you know, if a woman rocks a suit to a red carpet event, it is really cool. And I suppose that's slightly different because that's more about androgyny and fashion, and that's great. So I can't really think of another good example, but how powerful is that? Well, this has been extremely, extremely enlightening for me personally. I have to imagine for my listeners, and most of my listeners are probably a little bit younger than your typical client, but I'm hoping that in hearing this, you get to catch them young a little bit and just at least plant the seed and begin thinking about it and thinking about these choices we're making and having that knowledge to make informed decisions. Is there anything else in light of our conversation, in light of what we've talked about, that you feel like we need to dive into, you would like to clarify, you would like to return to? This is time for you to share, add anything, your space.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this forever. It's literally part of my job, right? So I guess in terms of kind of wrapping things up, just in your point about the fitting in with this culture and, you know, drinking the brown liquor and trying to fit in with male, this idea of this masculine being better, we don't have to accept that. We don't have to try to fit into something that isn't actively working for us. I believe that women are incredibly powerful. And if only we stopped holding ourselves back with stuff like alcohol, what we would be able to affect would be incredible. So, I mean, we don't have to drink to fit in like the boys, because we ourselves are so powerful that we can affect more change if we stop trying to essentially perpetuate what isn't really serving us and is definitely not made for us. I think that's really powerful. I think in terms of your audience, I it's encouraging to me to see that younger individuals are prioritizing their own mental health, their own physical health. They're not really willing to accept status quo, and they're willing to take action. And so I think that's what this all kind of flows into, is just recognizing how it's actually fitting into our lives, how it's showing up and what impacts it's having on us. And then what we're really willing to accept at this point. We've been really moving to, just as a society, stop accepting things that are just not serving us. And I think this is a really powerful way that we can stop it and kind of assert our own power and assert our own individuality, our own choices, our own freedoms, to say, I'm going to do what I want to do no matter what. You know, 60-70% people can drink, but I'm going to make my own choices, because at the end of the day, like, I'm here for me, right? You know, I'm my own best advocate. I know what's best for me, and I don't have to simply fit in if it's just not serving me anymore. So
how empowering. And yeah, the just, we don't have to accept it. It's so great. Yeah. Marcy, thank you so much for your time, energy, expertise, and the work you do. It is so clearly needed and necessary. So I'm just so appreciative of you coming on the podcast, sharing this information that hopefully pushes the needle forward a little bit more every single day. And I'm honored that you shared your time with me and with my audience. If anyone wants to work specifically with Marcy or learn more about her life coaching and other offerings that you have, all of Marcy's information will be in the video description. You can follow her across all socials that you may have. Everything will be down there, so definitely go check Marcy out. Is there anything in that regard that you would like to plug in addition to things?
Yeah, I mean, I love connecting with people. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that people have. If you want to reach out to me on social, I'm most active on Instagram. I also have a course that I help people with. Change your relationship with alcohol. So I know there can be a lot of shame and embarrassment when we can't drink like everybody else, when it seems like we can't do it and everybody else can, because that's the facade that we're all putting out, that we're all able to never have a hangover and drink like the boys, and it's fine, right? So I have a course, the way people can kind of work through this on their own time and in their own aspects. But yeah, I just honestly, I love having these conversations. Like I said, I could talk to you about this forever. I could talk to anybody about this forever. So if anybody has questions, comments, concerns, like, reach out to me. I'm an open book. So
I love that. Well, Marcy, final question to just round out our conversation, add a little bow. What is one word to describe how you are feeling right now?
My first word was excited. My first word was hot, because it is Texas and it's going to be 100 and something, but excited is really it. I get jazzed up about this. Like, you can tell that my energy and my excitement change when I start talking about things I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about alcohol-free living. I'm passionate about business. I'm passionate about the way they show up when you combine those two together. And it's something I can talk about all day, every day. It just gets me fired up, excited, and a little hot, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much again, Marcy. This has been absolutely fabulous.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you all so very much for being here today. And a big thank you to Marcy for sharing her heart and passion about this subject. Like I mentioned in the intro, this is truly something that I hadn't thought about at this level of intention before. And as a young person, alcohol is such a big part of my life when it comes to networking, but also social interactions, professionally and personally. Alcohol is we're inundated with it. And so being able to think about these things from a really educated and informed place is really important. So I was just personally very grateful to be able to have this conversation with Marcy and listen to her expertise. Again, if you would like to access Marcy, work with her, or learn anything else about all of the fabulous work that she does, everything will be in the description down below wherever you are listening to this podcast. If you are interested in the Cohere Collective, head over to www.thecoherecollective.com to check out everything else that we're doing. If you are curious about finding and pursuing your passion, that is the best place to get started. You can book a free consultation with me to see if there's any way we can partner together to help you pursue that purpose. So if that is the case, head on over there. You can also follow the Cohere Collective across all social media, all at the Cohere Collective. Instagram is our main one, but of course we're over on TikTok, Facebook, Threads, other ones, LinkedIn, all of the many social medias. We're all over there. So give us a follow if you'd like to keep up with what we're doing. If you would like to, you can follow me on Instagram at Lillian Reese Brown, and you can follow Marcy on Instagram at Coach Marcy Rossi. Links will all be down in the description. A big thank you to Nicole Ostreicher for Making Meanings art and podcast cover. And you can find her on Instagram at Nicole O Creates or Nicole O Designs. And a big thank you to Tristan Morgan for Making Meanings theme music. You can find him on Instagram at Tristan Morgan. Right now, I am feeling chaotic in a weird way. Tomorrow, if you have seen across any social media, is the day that I am moving to Europe. And I kind of have a lot of mess behind me from packing and preparing and doing all of the things, but it is also so exciting. So there are so many moving parts and pieces to this that, of course, you just don't even think about until it's there, but it's also a joyous chaos in that when you can lean into truth and honesty of the moment, it really helps at least me stay present. At least that's what I'm hoping it's doing. If you're curious about that journey, definitely stay tuned because I will be talking more about it in the future. As always, thank you so very much for being here, and I hope you feel like you are living more coherently. Until next time, love.